You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say. Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Harry Houdini. Say his name and a number of things come to mind. Escapes, illusions, magic, chains, safes, live burials. Close to a century after his death, nearly every person in America knows his name from a young age, capturing their imaginations with his death-defying stunts and daring acts. One of those kids was best-selling sports writer Joe Posnanski, and now he writes about the magician and his cadre of modern-day followers in his new book titled The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. And today, Joe joins me on the podcast to recall delving into the rabbit hole of Harry Houdini's legendary life and separating fact from the fiction invented by Houdini and his followers. Joe discusses the famous handcuffs that Harry Houdini almost couldn't get out of, some of the most bizarre things people challenged him to escape, including everything from a giant envelope to a giant football, and how when audiences began to lose interest, Houdini upped the ante with increasingly more dangerous escapes. He explains why many people falsely believe that the magician died performing one of his most famous tricks, and we talk about the secret code that Houdini's widow Bess used to try to make contact with him from beyond the grave. Joe also gives us entree into the world of Houdini superfans, from the couple who committed a crime to honor their hero, to the mysterious man who calls himself Houdini's ghost. Plus, he reveals what it's like in David Copperfield's private magic warehouse in Vegas, some of the turn of the century's most bizarre sideshow acts, and his daughter's favorite Houdini revenge story. Coming up with Joe Posnanski in just a moment. Joe Posnanski is a national columnist for NBC Sports and was a senior writer at Sports Illustrated from 2009 to 2012. He was named National Sports Writer of the Year by the Sports Writers and Sportscasters Hall of Fame and was twice named the best sports columnist in America by the Associated Press Sports Editors. He's the author of four books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Paterno, and now he's out with his latest book titled The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Joe, I have been a magic fan ever since I was a kid performing in my parents' backyard, so this book was a really, really fun read for me. But it's a little bit of a departure for you, it would seem, because here you are, you're a sports guy, and usually there's not much overlap in the Venn diagram of sports fans and magic fans. Where does your interest in Harry Houdini come from?
Yeah, it's funny hearing you give me that very nice introduction. I was sitting there thinking, wow, how did that guy end up writing a book about Harry Houdini? There is a little crossover.
Okay.
So for me, no, there isn't. You're 100% right. In fact, one of the magicians who's in the book, Joshua Jay, says that in the Venn diagram between magic and sports, it's him. Like, he's the only person in that little sliver. So you're 100% right. But I wanted to write this book about wonder. I had this idea that we used to, and when I say we, I mean people, in Houdini's time, in Babe Ruth's time, they used to really enjoy, you know, wonder and this idea of this, there are things that are impossible and beyond belief and so on. And, you know, a guy like Babe Ruth was bigger, I think, than any athlete could ever be today. You know, Babe Ruth used to, they used to tell stories of Babe Ruth being on the train and sports writers following him. And the sports writers would be playing cards and Babe Ruth would run through the train and then he'd be chased by a half naked woman with a knife. And, and the sports writers would like all look at each other and they'd say, okay, who's dealing next? Because they weren't going to write about it. You know, they weren't going to actually tell anybody. And I don't think in the age of Twitter that that would play in today's world. So, so I thought, you know, there's so much that we've gained, but what have we lost? And to me, you know, you talk about wonder, you're talking about magic, and you talk about magic, you're talking about Harry Houdini. And here we are, you know, today is Halloween. So we're, you know, 93 years after his death. And here is this guy who still lasts, you know, people still care about and know about and talk about. And, you know, I when I started writing the book, I had a Google News alert set up for every time Houdini's name was mentioned in a paper anywhere or online or whatever the case may be. And every single day since I started the book, there's something, usually 10 things or 20 things that mention Houdini, whether it's in politics and some politician, you know, escaped a crisis or a sports moment where a, you know, quarterback escaped a sack or just, you know, a life moment where a dog keeps escaping from a yard. Houdini is still so much with us. And I was like, why? What is it about this guy that that still stays with us, you know, so many years later? And so it started in some weird way with sports, but it definitely led to this whole new world that I knew absolutely nothing about, which was wonderful.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned Babe Ruth because, you know, I said that there wasn't much overlap, but in some ways, Houdini fans sort of resemble baseball fans in that they never saw him perform live. They probably never even saw a movie of his act in the same way that most modern baseball fans never saw Ty Cobb or Jackie Robinson play, but they love the stories. It's all about telling these legends, isn't it?
Absolutely right. You know, it's so funny, you know, among baseball fans, there's the famous called shot that Babe Ruth supposedly hit against the Cubs where he pointed in the World Series and then hit a home run to the spot where he pointed. And there's like, you know, sort of this grainy homemade footage and you can't really tell anything. It looks like Babe Ruth is maybe in the photo, but it's hard in the so hard to tell. And yet that is still a legend that people tell to this day. We don't even know if it's real. We don't even know if it's true. And in that's the perfect, you know, analogy to a guy like Houdini, who did all of these amazing escapes, you know, some of them famous in the way that, you know, the water torture cell or the mirror cuffs might be famous. And so many of them, which he did one time in a town because the town's, you know, carpenters decided to build a box that would hold Houdini prisoner. Or in Chicago, they put him inside a football, you know, try to get out of this. So all of these wonderful things that were one time only for a very small audience, you know, comparatively speaking, and yet we're still talking about it. And I think that was it's the power of escape. It's the power of his showmanship. But I think it's also just our hunger for these kinds of wonderful stories and mysteries, like you mentioned.
And it's interesting that he's become such a part of our culture because it's not like there weren't other famous magicians in Houdini's era, like Howard Thurston and Keller, etc. Yet somehow, no one outside of hardcore magic fans remember those names or even other celebrities of the day like Al Jolson, but everyone still knows Houdini.
That's exactly right. And you, as someone who is, you know, who has had a life interest in magic, knows that not only was there Thurston and Keller and so many others, they were better than Houdini. You know, I mean, Houdini was not a great magician. He was an escape artist. He was a showman. He was someone who kept finding new ways to sort of pair escape and danger, and he captured the imagination. But Houdini wasn't a great card magician or a great sleight of hand magician or someone who did these wonderful illusions the way that a Thurston did. And yet he was so good at building the legend of himself, building this larger-than-life figure, that he has blotted all of them out and blotted out many magicians today. Like if you ask somebody, who's the most famous magician in the world, they might say David Copperfield, or they might say David Blaine, or they might say Penn and Teller, and that's about it. Or they're going to say Houdini, because even now he still manages to sort of blot out all the other competition and somehow be at the top, which, you know, knowing Houdini's ego and ambition and drive would undoubtedly make him very, very happy.
And I have to imagine that Houdini must have been a difficult subject to look into, because there are so many different versions of the man, so many rabbit holes and stories that turn out not to be true or can't be verified. Did it make for a frustrating research process?
It's interesting, because I write about a guy named Ken Silverman, who wrote, I think, what most people inside of magic would still consider the best Houdini biography ever. You know, the one that really tried to separate fact and fiction and myth and truth and all of these things. I came at it from a very different perspective, which made what would have been a frustrating thing if I was trying to write a straight biography of Houdini. That would have frustrated me to no end. Like, you know, you hear this great story and okay, I'm writing it, and then, oh no, it wasn't true. But for me, the lies and the myths and the misdirection, it was part of the story. You know, it was fun for me to find out, oh, this isn't actually true, because even though it wasn't true, it's a story that built his legend and built his story. And my book is really about, you know, wonder today and what Houdini teaches us about that and about all of these people whose lives were altered by him and changed by him and inspired by him. And so all of these great stories, like one of my favorite points of the book is there's a very famous story of Houdini performing for the Tsar in Russia.
Right.
And supposedly he said, you can, you know, ask me for anything. And the Tsar said, can you make the bells of the Kremlin ring again? They have not rung for more than a century. Can you make them ring again? And Houdini went to the window and did some sort of, you know, magic-y hocus pocus move, waved a handkerchief, and the bells of the Kremlin rang. And the story is that Houdini's wife, Bess, had a little air gun that she shot at the bell to make them ring again. It is entirely untrue from really? The very beginning of the story. He did not perform for the Tsar. Like, nothing about that story is true. But that story was invented by Orson Welles, the great film director. So I, you know, on the one hand, you're like, oh, I can't tell that story. And then on the other hand, not only can I tell it, but I can tell that Houdini, you know, his power was so great that he inspired one of the great film directors of all time, 25 years after Houdini's death, to invent this beautiful story of Houdini, you know, fooling the Tsar of Russia. And it's, you know, that to me was so much fun, was not only getting to the myths, because I tell them, you know, as many of them as I can in this book there, but I never tell you, you know, that I tell you right away, I never tell you that it's the truth. I always say, you know, this is mythology. And that actually, very interestingly, for me as a writer, you know, and for you as a creator, it offered an opportunity to do something which I've always wanted to do, which was try to write magically, you know, try to create like a little illusion, a little magic trick. There are a couple of chapters in particular that I love, because there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end, just like a great magic trick. There's suspense, and then what you think is real, and then what is actually real. And, you know, Houdini was the ideal subject to try that kind of writing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing that Houdini wasn't just reinventing his own story, but now he's inspired other people to reinvent his story. And I think exactly I remember that story of him making the bells at St. Basil's ring from the Adrian Brody miniseries on History Channel. So that's totally untrue, and yet they included it in the movie, huh?
Yeah, I understand it, because it's such a good story that you want to film it, you want to put it on, you know, and they did include it, as they included a lot of other myths, by the way, in that miniseries. But it's wonderful to see, and, you know, to have not only, you know, his wife and his friends and other people sort of invent these legends about him. Like probably everybody has heard the legend that Houdini would get out of straitjackets by dislocating his shoulder.
Right.
Like that's like a big Houdini. It's totally untrue. But it was something people said while Houdini was alive. And Houdini loved it. He loved that people had, because he didn't actually come up with that. Somebody else did. And they said, is it true, Mr. Houdini, that you escaped by dislocating your shoulder? And Houdini was like, I'll never tell, right? I mean, he'll just he just played it off. And yeah, I mean, he created so much of his own myth, but he really did inspire other people to add chapters to it. And some of the most famous chapters are not Houdini inventions. They're other people who came up with them.
Now, I want to talk about Houdini's early days. You say in here that he overlapped with and worked with a lot of sideshow performers early on. And some of these acts are pretty funny. What were some of your favorites?
Well, my favorite one is one that is, again, maybe a myth, but it's one that Houdini specifically talked about. And that was a woman whose entire act was getting bitten by rattlesnakes. And that's all she would do. She would like go on stage. She would first have the rattlesnake like bite a rabbit and kill it. Like that was like to sort of like the, this is a real rattlesnake. And then the rattlesnake would bite her and she'd be fine. And like she would do this multiple times. And I thought, boy, that's, first of all, what a talent, right? Mm-hmm. I guess to be able to get bit by rattlesnakes continuously. But that's where he was. That was the world that he lived in. You know, he lived in the world where they would have, you know, Cowboy Ben, the cowboy who can play piano. You know, like that would be an opening act. Or Houdini would open for him. I mean, this mm-hmm. was at a time when Houdini was really unknown. So he would do these things for, you know, people who had odd, you know, the bearded lady and the giant man and you know, these kinds of sideshow performers. But also all kinds of weird. I mean, it was really fun. There's about a 2-page section in the book that you alluded to, where I just listed off a bunch of these, you know, wonderful, crazy, you know, the yodelers and people that you know, one person, like there was somebody he got into a fight with, so he bought a gun. I mean, it was such a ragtag, dangerous, you know, world that he lived in, and he was making no money. And he was just basically trying to figure out how to, you know, even stay on the road, because, you know, he had one great trick, which was metamorphosis, where he would have a partner who would get locked into a trunk, and, you know, tied up and then put in a bag and then put in a trunk. And then Houdini would say, count with me, 1, 2, 3. Oh no, Houdini would start in the trunk. And then his assistant would go, count with me, 1, 2, 3. And on 3, the assistant would disappear and Houdini would appear in their place. And you know, it was a big, you know, it was a big hit for a while, but you need more than one trick to sort of make a living at this thing. So he tried all kinds of stuff. He tried comedy. He tried music. He was in, you know, tried to be an actor. I mean, he tried all sorts of stuff because he was running out of real estate, I guess, on his magic stuff, to the point where he almost quit, where in 1898, he tried to sell all of his secrets and nobody bought. And that's where he was. He was at a point where he was a magician who nobody even wanted his secrets and you know, surrounded by all of these sideshow performers.
So then what was the big break for Harry Houdini?
Well, there really are two, but the biggest break for sure was very shortly, just months after he put out his catalog to sell all of his tricks. He went back on the road and was kind of finishing out a couple of previous engagements. And he was in Minnesota, and a man named Martin Beck, who was a big guy in Broadway, in vaudeville at the time, he was someone who owned the Orpheum circuit. There were theaters called Orpheum, which there's still some today.
And I think there's still a Martin Beck Theater on Broadway, isn't there?
That is correct. Yeah. Later on, after the whole Houdini scene, Martin Beck built the biggest vaudeville stage in you know, history in New York. And, you know, it was the Palace Theater and it was going to be this larger than life thing. And you know, to this day, there's a Martin Beck Theater in New York. So he was a big guy. He was still developing. You know, because later he'd become the biggest guy in Broadway, but he was still big. And he came to see Houdini and thought he saw something. He was as a talent scout, and he was a very talented guy at finding new acts. And he called Houdini, went to dinner with Houdini and Bass, his wife, and said, I'm going to be blunt with you. Drop the magic. The magic is not working for you. Your birds and your cards, and nobody cares. Everybody does that. But stick with the handcuffs. Stick with the escape. Like, that is your ticket. Is people are so taken by your ability to escape from any situation. That's your future. And Houdini rebelled at that at first. He was a big, big magic fan. You know, his name is, he named himself after the great magician Robert Houdin, where he added an I to the end of Houdin and became Houdini. So he didn't want to do it at first. But then he realized, I have no money, I have no jobs. It's Martin Beck. And he started to do it and almost instantly became a bit of a sensation, which is, you know, just tells you that he was obviously very good at what he did and he was a great showman and he just needed a break, and Martin Beck gave him the break. The second one is about a year later, after a very successful tour on vaudeville, he went to England, basically with nothing, no bookings, no reputation. He went to England because he'd seen a couple of other people make it big there. And through his sort of personal genius, his ability to promote himself like nobody ever had, and a few good escapes, he became the biggest thing in Europe, and then came back to the States and you know, at that point became, you know, maybe the biggest star on vaudeville.
And I think that this is the time when he gets introduced to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, right?
It is right around that time, correct.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised to read that you're not very interested in Houdini's later battles to expose the phony spiritualists and his relationship with Doyle. Why not? What's not to love about that?
Yeah, I do love it. I just don't love it the same way that I love the magic. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, to me, the point of this book was always about this, about wonder. And you know, I do talk about the spiritualism a bit and a little bit about his fight with Arthur Conan Doyle and you know, Houdini's, you know, the very famous time that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's wife did a seance to try to connect Houdini with his late mother, who was his life, and you know, she was the most important person to him in his life.
Right.
And then she, you know, wrote this long letter that she said was from Houdini's mother, and it had a cross at the top of it. And Houdini's father was a rabbi. So he basically putting a cross on the top of a rabbi's wife Houdini thought, wow, this isn't super real, and undoubtedly had some impact on him and his later fights with spiritualism. But I wanted to tell some of that story because it's important, but I didn't feel like, for me, because this is such a personal book and it's such a fun opportunity to tell great escape stories and tell stories about magicians today and magic today and all of that, that I didn't want to veer too far off course. And I felt like spiritualism was just a little bit out of bounds for me.
Well, Houdini was a consummate master of publicity, and he had this thing where he would invite the police or lockmakers or everyday people in every town that he visited to actually challenge him to escape, say, their local jail or a safe, etc. What were some of the more exotic challenges that you love?
Oh, I loved so many of them because every town was different. You know, mm-hmm. he would go to Pittsburgh, and then the Nurses Association had an escape where they tied him to a hospital bed, right? So it's like you would go to a beer, you know, a place where a beer distributor wanted to put him inside of a milk can filled with beer, you know, and he would go to, yeah, I mentioned the football that he had to escape from in Chicago. And you know, everywhere he went, it was something different. And you know, his only sort of exception was that he said you had to give me 24 hours with whatever contraption you build or whatever handcuffs you plan on using so that I can, you know, make sure that they're legitimate. Of course, what he was saying was so that me and my team can figure out how to get out. Mm-hmm. Right. So lots and lots of boxes. That was the big thing. People would, you know, create boxes and they would do super long nails so that there was no way for him to hammer his way out. Or they would, you know, he was put inside of a glass case. He was put inside of an envelope. He was put inside of a mailbag. I mean, it's so funny to think that, you know, something like this could survive now. But there he was, and it was very personal. That was, I think, a big part of his huge success was this was, you know, this was before everything, right? It was before radio, much less television or any kind of social media. So he came to your town. It was a big deal, especially, you know, after he was successful. And then he would say, hey, be near the newspaper office downtown at noon, and I'm going to hang upside down from, you know, five stories above the ground and escape from a straitjacket. And it's free. It's totally free. Just come downtown. And thousands and thousands and thousands of people would come, and they would see Houdini, you know, do that. And then, of course, you know, this was all promotion for people to come to his shows. But that's why more people saw Houdini than anybody of his time, because he would come and not just perform on stage, which was one thing, but he would do these bridge jumps where he would jump into the river off, you know, off of a bridge while wearing handcuffs, or he would do this buried alive escape, or he would do this, you know, the upside down straitjacket escape. And that was just to promote the name of Houdini. And so, you know, he was undoubtedly seen by more people than ever, I think, any performer had ever been seen before.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Joe Posnanski when we come back in just a moment. Today's episode is brought to you by Kronos. Kronos knows that for many organizations, maintaining a modern workforce of hourly, full, or part-time workers can be a challenge. This is especially true for human resources professionals working hard to attract and retain all of the best talent. That's why Kronos puts HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping on a single cloud-based platform. It's one especially designed to give HR professionals supporting a blended workforce a whole new level of confidence. With Kronos, they have everything they need to tackle nearly any human resources challenge and are empowered to not just find and hire the right people, but to engage, motivate, and reward them every step of the way. Learn more about Kronos HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them at kronos.com/HR swagger. That's kronos.com/HR swagger. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. Nobody goes into business because they want to collect sales tax for the government, but it's something that all businesses need to do. Thankfully, Avalara takes the mystery and pain out of the complex process of managing sales tax. Avalara uses the power of the internet and cloud services to automate the tax compliance process for businesses of all sizes, integrating directly with the accounting, e-commerce, point-of-sale, and marketing platforms that you're already using. Avalara software automatically calculates the right amount of tax that should be charged for every product in every transaction in real time and files your tax returns whenever and wherever they're due. Selling internationally adds a whole new level of complexity, but Avalara has experts in 15 countries around the world to help you navigate compliance challenges as you grow. And if you're a business owner like me, you know that managing sales tax is a complex and time-consuming process. It's easy to spend countless hours just trying to keep up with tax compliance instead of working on growing and improving your business. And at the end of the day, you still might not get it right, and you might get audited or fined. Stop spending valuable time worrying about your sales tax returns and focus on the things you actually love about running your business. Go to avalara.com/kick to learn more about how Avalara can help you. That's avalara.com/kick. Avalara, tax compliance done right. And now, back to the show. And I want to ask you about probably his most difficult challenge. A newspaper man in the UK challenges him to escape from these specially designed handcuffs called the mirror cuffs, which supposedly no one could get out of. What made these especially difficult? And to this day, I guess no one knows how he escaped them. What's your best guess?
Yes. Well, it's a super fun part of the book. It's like a whole section of the book where I go through people's theories. So these handcuffs, the story was that this reporter at the Daily Mirror, and that's why they're called the mirror cuffs, went all around the country to find these most inescapable handcuffs and found a locksmith in Birmingham who said that he had taken 5 years to build these handcuffs that could not be picked and could not be escaped from. And the thing that's sort of unique, there's a lot. The handcuffs still exist. They're in David Copperfield's private museum in Las Vegas. So I've seen them. They're beautiful. They're one piece. But the thing that makes them special is it takes a long key, probably 8 inches long, to open them. And in order to open them, what you have to do is you have to put the long key into this big lock, this side lock, and then you have to turn it like 5 or 6 or more different ways. So you have to, it doesn't just turn and open. You have to turn and then turn it back and then turn it forward and then turn it back. And there's no way, to pick them, especially there's no way even to get the pick into the lock while you're handcuffed by them because it's such a long key. So this was the challenge. And Houdini made a very big deal about not wanting to take it. And then he went on the stage and was on stage and he went behind his curtain. He had a little place he called a ghost box and tried to get out. And then he came out and everybody cheered and he still had the handcuffs on. And so he explained he needed some help. He needed to see some light or something. And then he went back in and then came out and everybody cheered. And he said, oh, my legs are hurting me. And so they bring him a pillow to stay in the thing. And he goes back in and he comes back out a third time and says, I'm very warm. Can you unlock the handcuffs so I can take my jacket off? and the guy, the reporter says, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, you've seen them only locked. You've never seen them unlocked. I'm not going to give you that. And Houdini, without even hesitating, sort of reached into his coat pocket with his teeth and pulled out a penknife and started like pulled his coat over his head somehow and slashed with the penknife and like tore the jacket off of his body.
Wow.
Using this penknife, which in itself is an amazing magic trick, by the way.
Yeah.
And the crowd goes crazy, just crazy. And this has been 45 minutes already of nothing happening, essentially. So they go absolutely crazy. And then 20 minutes later, he came out and he was free. And the place went, you know, insane, and they carried him on their shoulders, and he talked about it being the greatest thing he'd ever done, and you know, the Daily Mirror reporter conceded defeat, and it was this big moment, and it was played up quite big because it was a newspaper reporter who had issued the challenge, so all the Fleet Street papers were there, and it was, you know, it's by far, I think, the most recorded of all of Houdini's tricks, and yet, as you mentioned, 115 years later or so, we still don't know. We don't know how he did it. Everybody in magic has a theory about it. And I write about a bunch of those different theories. And then at the end, I couldn't help myself because this book has it doesn't reveal how he did things. You know, if people want to know how he did things, there are plenty of places out there you can find how he escaped from, you know, the milk can or whatever. But I had to throw my own opinion. So my own opinion, not to ruin it for people, but is that the whole thing was a setup by Houdini.
Really?
Yeah. And that he, you know, quite brilliantly invented this story. But there's only one way that I could see how he pulled it off, which is more interesting to me than the fact that it was a setup or not a setup. There's only one way I think he could have pulled it off, and I'm not going to tell people that. Hopefully, they'll read the book and see how he did it. At least how I think he did.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine people today sitting in a theater and waiting while someone behind a curtain tried to escape something for 45.
Could you imagine? That's one of the wonderful things about Houdini to me is everything he did. If you take 2 steps back, it's ridiculous. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like in the moment, but here he comes out and he goes, look, this is a water torture cell that I built myself and I invented. And now I'm going to go in it and I'm going to escape. And like, well, of course you are. I mean, you built the thing. Right. I mean, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And this was exactly the same thing. He would come out with handcuffs. He never would do handcuff escapes in public. He would always do them in his little, you know, box. So could you imagine today, like somebody saying, okay, I'm going to escape from these handcuffs. Hold on. I'll be right back. And then he would go into a box and then he'd come out and he'd have the handcuffs off. I mean, that would not exactly play. And it's, you know, there would, people would wait for 20 minutes, half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, you know, on some of these escapes, staring at nothing, just listening to a little band play music and just staring at a curtain, hoping he'll come out. And yet the tension was so thick and the nerves were so frayed that there are all kinds of stories of people in the crowd crying, just so they're so freaked out that he's going to die, you know, particularly on, with the water illusions, that he was going to die or he wasn't going to get out, or they were going to see the one time that Harry Houdini failed. And he really played up on that. And that's not working today, no.
Yeah, and I guess it's around midlife when he starts to worry that his star is fading. And that's when he decides to literally start escaping death with the water torture cell and other tricks that you've mentioned. Tricks where he would die if he couldn't escape, and they become increasingly more and more dangerous. There's almost a certain level of madness to this, no?
Oh, absolutely. There's madness. And it comes from a place of madness, which was that people were going to forget him, that people were going to lose interest in him. That was his sole fear. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he was not afraid of pain, and he was not afraid of, you know, of these dangerous things that he did, but he was afraid people were going to forget him. He was afraid he was not going to be famous anymore. He was not going to have money anymore. I mean, he grew up with nothing, and he was so fearful that time would move on and he would end up being back where he started. And so, he you know, there are wonderful, you know, wonderful as far as interesting diary things that he would write. He would say, you know, they didn't show up for me in St. Louis. Is this the end of Houdini? You know, he would have these very, you know, I mean, they weren't public because they were his diary, but these very outward feelings of fear that his time was going to pass. And so he did. He said, okay, so what I need to do is turn to danger, you know, because escaping from handcuffs, while extraordinary, you know, in that time, there was no threat, you know, it wasn't like he was going to stay in those handcuffs forever. Right. So he started with water, and, you know, water was a very big thing. He was a swimmer. He really, even before he started doing these kinds of escapes, he was fascinated by how long he could hold his breath. I mean, this was a big part of his, you know, athletic talents. And so the milk can was first, where he just filled up a milk can with water, and he would go in, and then they would put the cover on after they filled it up to the top, and he would escape from the milk can. And then he had to do it upside down. So then it was from the water torture cell. But as you said, it's like all of these other crazy things, like the bridge jumps, where he would, you know, jump into cold lakes and cold rivers, you know, while wearing handcuffs or being in a box or whatever the case. He was, you know, buried alive. You could bury me alive. He really did keep pushing the envelope, because every moment he was like, okay, people are going to grow used to this. They're going to grow tired of this. And what's my next chapter? What's my next chapter? And he took that all the way to the end of his life.
Yeah. And a lot of people think that he actually died performing one of those tricks, the Chinese water torture cell. But that comes from the Tony Curtis Houdini movie, right? That's not true.
Yeah, that's right. You talk about legend and how other people added to the legend. So the movie, the Tony Curtis movie in 1953 called Houdini, where Tony Curtis played Houdini and Janet Leigh played his wife, and she was his real wife. It was a big deal. And it was a big deal in two different time periods. It was a big deal in the 50s when it came out. And then in the 70s, it had a second life. Like, it became the every Sunday, you know, it would be on television basically. And so it is really, really influential. And the director, producer, both of them, thought that the way he really died, which is, of course, after getting punched in the stomach and having appendicitis, right, and all of that, that it was not worthy of a hero as big as Houdini. Like, I think the line was, you know, Houdini was too much, you know, was too much of a hero to die by getting punched in the stomach. So they had him die in the water torture cell. And for years and years and years, everybody thought that's how he died. I mean, it was pervasive. You know, one of the people I talk about in the book is a guy named John Cox, who is the leading, probably the leading Houdini expert, I think, in the world. Mm-hmm. And John fell in love with Houdini after watching that movie, but he soon found out that wasn't how he died. And he felt it was like his personal mission in life to tell people that Houdini did not actually die in the water torture cell. And people would argue with him. They'd say, no, that's exactly how he died. And he used to carry a book around with him to show people that Houdini did not actually die in the water torture cell. So yeah, that was, yet another of the incredible myths that Houdini did not invent and did not create that lived on way past him.
And here we are, we're talking on Halloween, the anniversary of his death. For 10 years after Houdini died, his wife, Bess, would hold a seance and try to contact him from beyond the grave.
Right.
As we mentioned, there were a lot of fraudulent mediums. So how would she know if Houdini had really tried to contact her from the great beyond?
Well, she and Houdini had created a code. They called the Houdini code, that there were a certain series of words that he would say, and then he would say, Rosabelle Believe, which was, you know, it related to the song that they shared. And basically Houdini said, if this is the code, then you will know it's me. Cause he knew that people were going to try to fake, you know, Houdini coming back. He was so related to spiritualism and so on and so forth. But then the whole thing kind of fell apart because a medium did come back with the code, which, you know, we later found out was essentially given to him by Bess. And the whole thing kind of turned into a sad little moment of time because Bess came out in public and said, oh, this is the real story. Houdini really has come back. And then later she had to say, yeah, okay, maybe not.
Yeah, wasn't she having an affair with the guy?
We believe, like, okay. Again, one of the many things that you don't know. She definitely liked him a lot. She definitely thought of him as a handsome con man. Whether or not they were actually having an affair is up for debate. Mm. But definitely some weird stuff. But Bess, Bess is a hugely important part of this story. Mm. I think if it had not been for Bess, those 10, 15, 20 years after Houdini died, he might very well have been forgotten. I mean, he was very, very famous and a part of the language and all of those things. But, you know, people fade. I mean, the most famous people of his time, like you mentioned, Al Jolson and, you know, even Charlie Chaplin, who had such a long stretch, is very much, you know, in the background now. Buster Keaton, guys like that. And so she was relentless about her publicity, relentless about the Houdini code, relentless about getting a book written about him. She was very much involved in getting the movie made. So she was someone who kept pushing and kept pushing. And I feel like she definitely bridged a very big gap until the movie came out. And then the movie was very successful for about 20 years. And then a whole bunch of other people took over and continue to this day to sort of share his story.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the Houdini fans in the time we have left, because this book is as much about them as it is about the man himself. One couple that you run into are Dick and Dorothy Dietrich, who are two hardcore fans. They built a Houdini museum in their hometown, and I guess they even committed a crime to honor their hero, right?
Yes, that is correct. I'm actually going. The Houdini Museum is in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which has no connection whatsoever to Houdini, other than I guess he performed there, maybe. But that's their hometown. Dorothy is actually kind of a legend in her own right. She is a magician, and you know, in the 70s, she got quite popular. She was the first woman on television to saw a man in half. She kind of turned that all around. She did the bullet catch. She did, you know, various upside down straitjacket escapes. And she's actually the person that the Isla Fisher character in Now You See Me is based on. So she has a real background in magic. And then her husband, partner Dick Brooks, is this, you know, very fascinating guy who also has had a long life in magic. And they love Houdini. I mean, love him, obviously, enough to build a museum in his honor. And yeah, they, what happened was at Houdini's gravesite, there is a bust of Houdini's head. And it has been there since the beginning, except every Halloween, usually, although it could be any time of the year, people would come in and they would steal the bust, or they would vandalize the bust. And it got to the point where they basically said, okay, you know what? We're taking the bust away. This is only hurting. So for many years, there was no Houdini bust at the place. And Dick and Dorothy did not like that. And they did. They broke in to the cemetery and put their own bust in there that they had specially made. You know, they were caught. They did get caught.
Yeah.
And the cemetery people let them do it, because why wouldn't you at that point? But that was their plan, was to secretly go in there and return this Houdini bust to the gravesite.
And there's also this elusive figure that you sort of chase throughout the book, who bills himself as Houdini's ghost. Toward the end, you finally meet up with him at the Magic Castle in L.A. What's he like?
He is a true character, just say. His name is Pat Culliton, and he is an actor, was an actor, and still does some acting, who had a very rough, you know, he went to Vietnam and came back, and like many who went, you know, didn't find the same life for himself when he came back, and acting jobs were hard to come by, and he had always loved Houdini and decided to start going around the country and doing like circuits, talking about Houdini, doing a few of Houdini's tricks, called himself Houdini's ghost. And as time kept going on and on, he started becoming this very, I mean, legendary Houdini expert. And he put out these very odd but super interesting books about Houdini, about his life, about his secrets, and they're impossible to get. They're impossible to find. He only printed a few copies of each, and they're like these little bits of gold inside the world of Houdini. I felt like it was really important to talk to him. He did not want to talk. And then I kind of wore him down, I guess, and was able to meet with him at the Magic Castle in L.A., which is this wonderful clubhouse of magic. And I wrote about him, and I wrote about him, I think, quite lovingly. I you know, really moved by his story and his life and his energy and his passion. But I will tell you, he hates the book. I mean, hates the
your book.
Yeah. Oh, hates
really?
It.
Why?
I mean, to an extreme. It's why is a very difficult thing to come by. You know, it says, this is the most dishonest book ever written about Houdini. And I'm like, well, what's dishonest about? No, I can't tell you. So, and I think in a way that I mean, of course, I wish he would have liked it. I worked very hard to make him, you know, come alive, and I wish he would have liked it. But in a way, it's better that he doesn't, because there's so much of Houdini in him, and there's no doubt in my mind Houdini would not like the book. Not because of anything specific in the book, but because he didn't write it. You know what I mean? It's not Houdini's.
Yeah.
And nothing Houdini hated more than imposters. Yeah. Anybody trying to make a dime off of his name was enemy number one. And so, you know, in a way, I kind of appreciate that Patrick, you know, I think Patrick's like, hey, you know, I'm in this book, but I didn't write it. So I understand that. And I still love the guy. I still love the guy.
Now, if there's anyone who might be considered the successor to Houdini, I suppose it would probably be David Copperfield. You say in here that Copperfield and Houdini are nothing alike and entirely alike. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, they're nothing alike in the way they perform. They're nothing alike in the way that they act. I mean, they're very, very different people. David Copperfield didn't even come from magic. You know, David Copperfield was a prodigy, right? But he loved Broadway. He loved songs. He loved movies. And he, you know, he made his career on sort of building magic through those things, you know, through the lens of Broadway or you know, music. And you know, Houdini was totally different in that way. And they were totally different personalities. I mean, David Copperfield is not the bully that Houdini was, or you know, they're just different. But then you step back and you go, okay, David Copperfield changed his name. You know, he's a young Jewish kid who fell in love with magic, changed his name, became the world's biggest magician, and there's a relentlessness to Houdini and to Copperfield that I don't think anybody else has. Because I think you could make a pretty good argument in the magic world that the guy who is the direct descendant of Houdini is actually David Blaine, right? Because David Blaine does all of these escapes, right, and crazy stunts and all of this. But Copperfield works so hard, even now. He's a billionaire, and he owns like seven islands. And yet, you go to Vegas on Christmas week, he's doing three shows a day. Christmas week.
Wow.
And why? You know, what is it that drives? And I thought to myself, if I could figure out what it is that drives David Copperfield to do that at a point in his life when he is, you know, the most successful guy, I can figure out why Harry Houdini, when he was the most famous, you know, magician, escape artist, performer, maybe in the world, why he still, despite you know, being in agonizing pain, refusing to get off the stage in Detroit, you know, because the show must go on. And so to me, that there's a connection there that is obvious. You know, the two guys who changed their name and became world famous magicians. And then there's some drive and ambition that those two people have that I think is less obvious, but every bit as interesting.
Yeah, I can definitely see that connection of that need to constantly be one-upping yourself and doing something new to keep people interested, because it makes me think of, you know, when he vanished a jet, and then after he vanished a jet, he had to make the Statue of Liberty disappear. It's just getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it's an endless, it's you'll never do, I think in magic, you'll never do the perfect illusion, right? Mm-hmm. There's always something better, something bigger, something better, something more amazing, something more impossible. And, you know, I think both of them have been in search of that. I think both of them live on the stage in a way that's different from the way they live the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And then there's just something else that's very difficult to capture about both of them. You know, I think Houdini spent his whole life building Houdini, you know, making Houdini something bigger and grander than anything that had ever come before him. And I think there's a little bit of that in Copperfield, too. I mean, he's got this incredible museum, private museum in Las Vegas, which he was kind enough to let me tour. And you know, it's a magic trick all its own. I mean, it's the most extraordinary thing. It's like walking into his mind. Yeah. And, you know, he loves that. It's beautiful. He loves that. And then he's performing, you know, a completely new act in Vegas, which involves an alien and so on, trying to find, you know, new ways to push magic. And I think that they connect that way. I think they connect in that there was never enough. There's always something more, and they're never going to stop chasing.
Yeah. And I'm so jealous that you actually got to visit his warehouse, because David Copperfield, he has this almost legendary magic collection that I think is the biggest in the world, a private collection that he houses in this warehouse in Vegas. And in my imagination, I'm sort of picturing something like the closing scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark or something. Is that about right? And what kind of stuff is in there?
That is about right. It's the most extraordinary place I've ever been in its own way. You know, you walk in and there's a perfect representation of his father's store, a men's store in New Jersey. It's exactly, you know, shirt for shirt, like that men's store in New Jersey. And then you go to the back in my time, because I think he's changed it a lot. You go to the back and you pull a tie and the whole back wall opens up. And then you're in the world's greatest collection of ventriloquist dummies, because he started off as a ventriloquist.
Wow.
And
really?
And it's creepy and weird, but interesting. And then you walk into one of the world's largest Broadway collections because of his love for Broadway. And then a huge movie collection where he has like all kinds of, you know, posters, but also, you know, bits of sets from different movies. And then the magic is, you know, it's beyond belief. I mean, from the world's most extensive magic library to, you know, posters and props of every great magician, you know, through two centuries. And then on top of that, he has the world's largest Houdini collection, which is the most cherished part of all. So he has the water torture cell, and he has the mirror cuffs, and he has all of these handcuffs and keys and posters and letters and everything else. And it's incredible. It's the kind of place where at some point the producer, his producer, took me to a back room where he was going to show me some other things. And it wasn't for public view. It was just like a little back room. And there was a couch there and a table, just a ratty old little place, and a lamp. And as we're leaving, he showed me the letters he wanted to show me. And we're leaving, he said, oh, feel this. And he reached behind the lamp and pulled out an Academy Award. And really? I'm like, what? And he handed it to me. And he said, feel how heavy this is. Isn't this really heavy? Like, it's amazing that they're on stage and they hand them an Oscar and it's so heavy, I can't believe more people don't drop them. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting, yeah. And then he puts it back behind the lamp and we get ready to leave. Like, that's it. Like, this is, nobody will ever see this. It's nothing. And so we're walking out and I said, you know, can I ask you a question? And he's like, yeah. Whose Oscar is that back there in the middle of nowhere behind a lamp? And he says, you know what? I don't even know. And we go back and he pulls out the Oscar and it's the Oscar of that Richard Curtiz won for directing Casablanca.
Oh my God.
And I thought the director's Oscar for Casablanca, one of the great movies ever made, yeah, is like in this storage room in the back. I mean, that's the kind of museum this place is. Dizzying, absolutely dizzying.
Well, before we go, I know that you've apparently passed down your love for Harry Houdini to the next generation in your family. You say that your daughter shares your interest in Houdini and particularly Houdini revenge stories, right?
Yeah, it is true. My oldest daughter, who gave me the hardest time during this book because she just constantly was like, yeah, I feel like we're haunted by this guy. This guy won't go away. And you know, but all along sort of showing a little interest and a little, a little bit of fun and kind of getting into it a little bit more and more and more. And, you know, but she still never stopped giving me a hard time about it. But then I started telling her some of the Houdini revenge stories. And, you know, my favorite one is he was on tour and he heard about a guy who called himself Clapini and who was doing his act. And it so enraged him that he went to the head of the tour and said, listen, I'm taking off the next 3 days. I mean, Houdini never did this. He said, I'm taking off the next 3 days. You're going to have to cancel those shows or I'll do them at the end, but I'm leaving. And he left and he went and found this very, by the way, let's just say, very obscure magician, escapologist who was doing no business. You know, he was nobody, but he went there. He dressed up like an old man, and then Clapini, you know, did his bit, and then he said, is there anybody in the audience who wants to challenge me? And Houdini comes out dressed up like an old man when he walks up with a cane, and he says, I want to challenge you, and he pulls out these handcuffs, and he puts them on Clapini, and as soon as he puts them on, he tears off his costume and says, the audience may go home now, for no man who Harry Houdini locks into chains ever escapes. And everybody goes crazy, and Clapini's finished, and, you know, of course, he couldn't get out, and that's the story. And so of all of the Houdini stories that I told my daughter, that was the one that she loved. Like, she loved, like, tell me more revenge stories by Houdini. So she liked the dark side of Houdini, yeah, I guess.
Well, again, the book is called The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. Joe Posnanski, thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, gosh, thank you. This was great.
Thanks again to Joe Posnanski for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Keep up with him at joeposnanski.com or on Twitter at jposnanski. Folks, I've been a small business owner for just about 20 years now, so I know how easy it is to waste a lot of time trying to keep up with taxes. And tax laws are so complicated, at the end of the day, you still might get it wrong. So stop wasting valuable time worrying about your sales tax returns and focus on the things that you actually love about running your business with a little help from Avalara.
Avalara simplifies sales tax compliance with real-time rates and automatic filing. Their software seamlessly integrates with the systems you're already using, so it couldn't be easier. Go to Avalara, AVALARA.com/kick to learn more. Avalara, tax compliance done right. Today's episode is brought to you by Kronos. Kronos provides HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support, motivate, and engage them. They put HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping on a single cloud-based platform. Learn more about Kronos HR, payroll, talent, and time at kronos.com/HR Swagger. That's kronos.com/HR Swagger. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com. And I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.